capital region. This is the Hudson Mohawk Magazine, broadcasting from the Sanctuary for Independent Media in Troy, New York. I'm Justin.
And I'm Kalen. Today on the Hudson Mohawk Magazine, we begin with Paul Smart's report on the Albany protest and their use of tear gas. Then we honor the 55th anniversary of the killing of Edson Thevenin. Later on, Mark Dunley talks with Samuel Rose, who is running for Schenectady School Board elections. After that, Kate Phipps talks about the breakout session at the upcoming Sustainable Futures Conference. Finally, we continue last week's interview with artist Megan Van Alstyne. But first, here are some headlines.
The Times Union reports that Albany County is beginning to see a few deaths again from COVID-19 after several weeks with no deaths. The uptick is occurring even as half of the county residents have now been vaccinated. At least 371 Albany residents have died from COVID. On Sunday, the state reported 35 deaths from COVID statewide, mainly downstate.
After nearly 2 months of litigation, 58 immigrants detained at the Buffalo Federal Detention Facility have received a COVID-19 vaccine.
Black Lives Matter protesters have set up an occupation outside the police station on R Street in the south end of Albany after officers pepper sprayed a crowd on Wednesday. They want an officer whose aggressive actions caused an injury to a woman to be fired. The Albany City Council is voting this week on the use of tear gas by the police. Protesters also gathered under the Collar City Bridge in Troy on Saturday to mark the 5th anniversary of the police killing of Edson Thevenin during a traffic stop.
The Record reports that work has begun on a $2.6 million project to replace Route 2 Bridge over the Posting Kill in the town of Brunswick. Work is scheduled to be completed by the end of the year. During construction, the bridge will be limited to a single lane.
The city of Albany will be adding 5 new electric vehicle DC fast chargers across 2 new locations. The chargers will be located in Quaken Bush parking lot and lot 3, located at 327 Washington Avenue. There are an existing 11 stations with 19 ports across 3 locations. For those of you just tuning in, you're listening to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine on WOC Low Power 105.3 FM Troy and WOS Low Power 98.9 FM Schenectady, WOA Low Power 106.9 FM Albany, and WCAA Low Power 107.3 FM Albany, coming from the Sanctuary for Independent Media in Troy.
Our mission is to use art and participatory action to promote social and environmental justice and freedom of creative expression. This program is produced by the community members and funded in part by monthly donations from Sanctuary Sustainers. To learn more how you can contribute to Media Sanctuary, go to mediasanctuary.org and email us at hmm@mediasanctuary.org or call us at 518-272-2390.
We begin with a report by HMM's Paul Smart about the recent protests against police violence, the use of tear gas, and what took place at the APD South Station.
While the nation has again been wrestling with the death of young black men at the hands of police, exemplified in 2 fatal shootings of late in the ongoing trial in Minnesota, Albany has been wrestling with a new policing plan that many call inadequate and a proposed ban on most uses of tear gas, which was utilized last spring in the city.
And I just think that we, if we completely take it away, it would leave us in a bad spot, and we risk harm to both our citizens, our police, maybe even property. But again, the changes I made, if anyone has any questions about it, I made it so the chief or deputy needed to be on site making that call. I mean, that if you think about adding these things, it narrows down the likelihood of it being used. So chief or deputy on site, making that determination. Again, the riotous situation that when we had that public safety meeting, everyone was talking about riot and the definition of riot, and we're going round and round. So what I did was I went into the New York State Penal Law to the riot section, riot first, and that's where that language came from. The 11 or more folks engage in violent and tumultuous behavior, property damage, people getting injured and whatnot. There's a couple I believe Mr. Hoey was first.
Thank you, Kelly. I was shocked when I saw your changes. I'm going to be honest. We did not have the kinetic weapons in the original, and you put it back in, rubber bullets. I try to tell you, I have a cousin lost his eye because of rubber bullet. They're doing this again in Ireland. You see the stuff going on. A country or a state or a municipality that has to use violence against their own citizens, that's not the country that I was born to. I'm sorry. Now, we heard from the police themselves, this gas has not been used twice in 30 something years. So what did they do? And nobody's answering me. What did you do before we had this gas?
A protest rally started before Common Council discussion of the tear gas ban continued last Wednesday and resulted in a series of actions at the South Station of the Albany Police Department, where another chemical assailant, pepper spray, was used by police on protesters. We and other media around the city reported on what occurred on location. Later, Albany Police Chief Eric Hawkins and Mayor Kathy Sheehan responded to what was reported.
What we saw Wednesday evening was not a peaceful protest. It was a riot. It was a planned, premeditated, calculated effort on the part of individuals to attack police officers and police property. And their motivation appeared to be to elicit a response from police officers, a response that would be recorded, their recording manipulated, and then used to further a false narrative about what happened during that incident and about similar incidents that have been happening not just here, but across the country. And we have a series of videos that we will be sharing. Some of those videos are from fixed mounted exterior cameras outside of South Station. Others are from body worn cameras from the officers who were on the scene. Personally, I was sickened by what I saw, because for me, it was another example of individuals who were using the cover of peaceful protests, hijacking those protests, and using that cover to engage in violent and destructive behaviors.
I have to say, our officers, particularly our black officers, were subjected to language and slurs that, had they been uttered by a coworker, that coworker would have been fired. They sought to de-escalate the situation. They removed themselves from the front of South Station. It was only after the protesters were banging on the doors, trying to get in, breaking a window, all of that done by protesters, not by the police, by protesters, in a scene that was eerily familiar to us and reminded me of what we saw at the Capitol on January 6th. None of that was reported by the media. Many of you were not there when these incidents occurred, but some of you saw them and chose not to report them. Protesters violently assaulting South Station, using a blinding light to interfere with officers' ability to do their jobs, and screaming provocations, including disgusting racial slurs at black officers. You know, the way that these events are depicted in the media matters. The way that these events are depicted in the media can result in danger and violence. And it does matter. It does matter. And so I just know that I received my degree in journalism before most of you were born, but I believe that all of us were taught that the principles of truthfulness and accuracy and objectivity and fairness are a part of what we are taught.
On Saturday, another protest started at Townsend Park and marched to South Station, where we again caught up with protesters, including organizer Legacy Casanova.
So tell me about tonight. How's it been going and what's going to happen at this point?
Tonight, you know, we still plan on occupying until the officers resign. Officer Anderson, well, Lieutenant Anderson, Officer Felton, and Chief Hawkins, we want them to resign. We also want Kathy Sheehan to resign. And if it doesn't happen, we're going to keep being out here protesting constantly. Right now, tonight, it's our first night. We're out here basically, you know, demanding for them to basically resign. And if they don't, then we're going to continue to be out here. They assaulted us, used force, pepper spray, and that's not right at all.
What happened today with the woman in the car?
So there was a lady that tried to run us over. I'm not sure what happened. I just know she tried to run into the crowd, and people were just like, you know, move over and just basically let her go.
I can tell you about that.
Okay.
I'm the one that put her back into her car. She was yelling terrible, terrible slurs at every person of color in sight. Like, she spit on two people. She got out of her car and was chasing after people. And the cop sat there watching this whole thing happen and did nothing.
Was this up around the Capitol?
Yes. Yes.
This is as you were marching down?
Yes. She attempted to drive through the crowd at first and was asked why she did it and just started going off on people. If she was like going nuts. I don't know what her problem was, but
did she eventually just got in her car and left? Or?
No, she had to be removed from the people so the march could continue as the cops were watching this whole thing happen.
Yes.
And as somebody held her back so everybody could move on, she was yelling and screaming and then was slamming that person with her car door that was trying to hold her away from people. And the cops were literally standing right there watching it happen.
Earlier on Saturday, Mayor Sheehan put out a news statement retracting some of what she had said the day before. Albany residents have reached out to me regarding my comments at Friday's press conference comparing the insurrection at the U.S. Capitol on January 6th to Wednesday's attack on South Station, it read. My comments referred to the physical actions of the use of violence to attempt to gain unlawful entry into a government building. To be clear, the January 6th insurrection was fueled by white supremacy and was an assault on our democracy. In no way did I intend to compare the insurrection to the BLM movement or protests. I am sorry.
Jamaica Miles, and one of the problems that Albany is facing is the discussion over whether or not to ban tear gas. While elected officials are debating, people have been adamant, the residents in Albany and the individuals that come through for whatever reason have been really adamant that there needs to be a full ban on tear gas. And so Monday, there's still the call for people to testify at the Common Council meeting, to send emails, to make calls to their representatives and send text messages, which we did on Wednesday. Started that on Wednesday and calling for that to continue because it is the people's voice that needs to be heard. And Kelly Kimbrough and Michael O'Brien need to hear that.
And what about the so-called plan, which... will that be able to come back onto the table at some point?
I mean, what plan and plan by who? Because what we saw in the city of Albany, we saw in every other city, that there was a performative representation of creating change. And then once it was all over, the police chief and the mayor made the decision about what was going to move forward. And it wasn't the voice of the people. The people are demanding to be heard.
And then any word on the Sheehan administration's response to this in today's Times Union?
It was I can't even say disappointing what Sheehan said in response to Wednesday. The fact that she compared it to January 6th and then tried to backpedal as if saying sorry was going to take back the racist remarks that she made. She has messed up and she has shown the people that she doesn't understand the plight of this marginalized and abused community and that she continues to side with their abuser, the cops.
So is it going to be a long summer or are we making progress at some point in the year?
I think that there has been progress, even though incremental, but not in the way that we need. We have changed the culture of the Capital District. We've changed the culture of Albany about what we will accept and how we're going to show up. It is a culture of protest. And that is something that those who are uncomfortable with it, they're going to have to get comfortable because it's only going to grow. We're not going to wait 20 years for change.
Monday night, April 19th, simultaneous to this broadcast, the Albany Common Council was set to vote on their amended ban on tear gas while the protests outside South Station continued.
Black Lives Matter! Black Lives Matter! Black Lives Matter!
We will maintain our reporting on what unfolds from a community perspective. This has been Paul Smart reporting for Hudson Mohawk Magazine.
That was HMM correspondent Paul Smart reporting on the protest against the state of policing and other militaristic police tactics used.
As violence continues against black and brown communities around the country, activists in Troy held a rally on Saturday called Spring Into Action. Rally for Black Life. April 17, 2021 was the fifth anniversary of the killing of Edson Devenant. And in this segment, we hear a statement from his mother, Gertha Depas.
We stand
for Black Life. For Black Life.
On Saturday, April 17th, on the fifth year anniversary of the killing of Edson Devenant, activists in Troy gathered to honor him and Black Life. In an event organized by Troy for Black Lives and Reimagine Troy, the day started with an altar building and honoring of ancestors.
Call on them. Say their names. Call them into the space. This is what this moment demands.
Luce Marquez Benbow from Troy for Black Lives kicked off the event.
The police department in this city lynched a man, a person, a father. His name is Edson Devenant. And today is his fifth year anniversary. And to Edson, to Thaddeus Faison, who was killed in 2015, to Ashawn Sean, the 11-year-old who we lost last year, and to all the names of those known and unknown whose bodies have been taken from us by a government who approves it, a system that is okay with killing black bodies. We also want to call and give honor to the many that some of you have the audacity to call gun violence, that some of you have the audacity to call street violence, that some of you actually freaking think that we don't care about when crime happens in our communities. We care, but we understand that to be a connection and a direct link to the over-policing of our communities. There is a war on crime, and who are the criminals that they think? Our black bodies. Don't get confused. You want to stop gun violence? Then stop white supremacy. You want to stop guns in the streets? Defund the police! Every black life matters! Yeah. Everyone!
That passionate plea to stand up for all Black lives was made by Luz Marquez Benbow, one of the MCs of the event and a member of Troy for Black Lives. April 17th not only marks the anniversary of the killing of Edson Thevenin by Troy police officer Randall French, but it is also Edson Thevenin's brother's birthday. And therefore, his mother, Gertha Deepas, could not attend the rally, but she did send a statement. It was read by the former president of the NAACP, Jessica Ashley.
Injustice to one is injustice to us all. My heart pains for every mother who has endured the pain that I have endured. My heart grieves for the children who will no longer know the comfort of a parent and the spouses whose support has been violently snatched from them. The unjustified killing of men and women in the Black and brown communities by those who have sworn to protect and to serve is a crime to humanity and modern day genocide. A loss of life is a loss not only to the family, but to a loss to us all. And until this dysfunction is addressed, how can we expect for our children to have a better future? The Troy Police Department took the life of my son, attempting to rob us of the dignity of his life through false statements and propaganda, while the officials presided over the sanction and miscarriage of justice for Edson. 5 years have not eased the pain. It has intensified the struggle. These are the words of a mother. She not only represents the one, but she represents every son, every daughter, who has been assaulted, brutalized, murdered by the police, and sanctioned by a system that allows these crimes to continue. This is modern day lynching. The problem is that we allow it to happen. The power has always been in the hands of the people. It is only when the people cry out and stand up and say enough is enough, it is then that the changes take place. It is time for us to stop being told when we are to meet, how long we are to meet, and what we are to talk about. It is time for us to move and to be where we choose to be, to speak out where we need to speak out, be it City Hall, be it wherever it might be, in front of the Troy Police Department, where the criminals are held up and continuing to violate the rights of the people in the city. Crime is crime. There is nothing in a law book that says that the police can commit crime and get away with it. We need to come out in numbers. We need to be seen continuously, and we need to be crying out daily, enough is enough. We cannot allow the mayor to rest. We cannot allow the chief of police to rest. We cannot allow any police in this city to rest until they understand this is our city and enough is enough.
That was Jessica Ashley, the former president of the Troy NAACP, speaking on Saturday at the Troy Rally for Black Life under the Collar City Bridge and in front of a banner that read Black Lives Matter and an altar of flowers celebrating Black life. Messiah Cooper, Demeek McDonald's uncle, also spoke at the event. He lamented about waiting to be activated until police violence hit home.
We're here on the day that Edson Thevenin's life was taken. There was a public hanging on this day. But we are here because my nephew was shot. Because if my nephew wasn't shot, I wouldn't have acted. And I failed to act along with the community when they took Edson Thevenin's life. Right. It still hurts me.
Yeah.
I thought I stood for truth until I looked in the mirror at me and said, how could I allow them to take the life of a Black man? And just because I didn't know him, I didn't stand for him.
Come on, bro.
When you stand for us or any black life that's been taken or been robbed of their liberties, do it because your heart tells you to do it. Do it because if it was your baby, your husband, your son, your daughter, you wouldn't tolerate it.
Right.
Do it because if you don't do it, you'll feel like me.
After Messiah Cooper of Troy for Black Lives spoke, Delilah Yean took to the mic to tell her story about surviving police violence as a black immigrant.
I'm a mother, an activist, and an immigrant, and a black woman living in America. 2 years ago, I was arrested by Troy PD for doing a rolling stop through a stop sign. As a result of that arrest, I spent 3 months in an ICE detention facility. I was ripped away from my two minor children, and I spent upwards of a year fighting to stay in this country and in this city that I've been living in for 18 years, more than half of my life. My children were born here, and so it was super traumatic. It's still traumatic for me to talk about it, and I'm going to speak on some of the traumas that we as black and brown people go through every day in this country. We start businesses, we raise our babies, and we do it all while smiling in the face of injustice. We teach our children to love and embrace each other. We educate our friends and families. We embrace other cultures and nationalities in ways that we have never been embraced.
Right.
The progress we are making in this city and this country does give me hope. We have more young politicians and council people of color than we have ever had before in history.
Yeah!
We are creating change and holding people accountable at a rate like never before. The world is watching and paying attention. Now is the time for change to happen.
That was Delilah Yean from Columbia County Sanctuary Movement talking about hope for the future and her own traumatic experience that began with the Troy Police Department. Next, we hear from John Larkins, another survivor of Troy police violence.
The police almost killed me right here in Troy. I was saving someone's life. I was studying to become a cop. I don't believe in any good cops. If I could go to the hospital, try to save someone who can't translate for themselves with a broken leg. I had a broken leg when this happened. The police tasered me 5 times directly to the back of my head and the back of my neck for 21 seconds. Let that sink in, because a family just reached out to me the other night saying that their family in New York, he died from 2. I left Troy, New York. I didn't think that y'all existed. And I am completely remiss of that fact. I had to leave to Boston because they were outside of my house with their lights on, outside of my deaf grandma's house, harassing my little cousins as they come home from school. I had to leave. So for that, I apologize to y'all. But I will say this. I've been real busy. I've been hella busy, because this justice movement don't stop. I tell you what, Troy, do not disconnect yourself from what's going on in this country, because we are in the middle of it.
That was John Larkins, who recounted his story of being tased by Troy police while trying to help a family member. Many more community members took to the mic to share their call for reform and defending the police before the event shifted to a march and taking of the intersection at Hoosick and 8th Street, where Sergeant Randall French killed Edson Thevenin 5 years ago.
This is huge! And I know that you saw some families waving to you from their streets. They're looking for this! And next time they might come out! So next time you say, we love you! You tell them, we love you!
We love you!
A strong thanks to WOOC reporter Elizabeth Press on this powerful piece on police violence in Troy. Our heart goes out to Edson Thevenin, his mother, and others affected by police violence.
For those of you just tuning in, I'm Justin.
And I'm Kalen. You're listening to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine on the Hudson Mohawk Radio Network.
To learn more about this program and how to support the Sanctuary for Independent Media, visit us online at mediasanctuary.org. If you have comments, suggestions, or warm regards, email us at hmm@mediasanctuary.org or find us on social media at Media Sanctuary.
Samuel Rose has been endorsed by the Green and Socialist parties in his campaign for the May 18th election for Schenectady School Board. He discusses his charter school, the search for a new school superintendent, and COVID by Mark Dunley for the Hudson Mohawk Radio Network.
We're talking with Samuel Rose, who is a candidate in the May 18th election for the Schenectady School Board. He has been endorsed both by the Upper Hudson Green Party and the Capital District Socialist Party. So, Sam, why don't we just talk off just briefly about, why did you decide to run for the school board?
Thanks, Mark, for having me. In terms of why I wanted to run, I have been a lifelong resident of the city of Schenectady. I have been interested in educational issues for a while now, being someone that, first went through the school system here in Schenectady. I graduated from Schenectady High School in 2006. Through my college and graduate school career, now I work at the New York State Education Department. I was interested in a way of kind of injecting people's politics into the city of Schenectady. I've been frustrated in the past few years about how Democrat-centered, politics in Schenectady has become and how it's really been dominated more by business interests and, closed backroom deals than it is by like the wishes and interests of the people themselves. So the main thrust of why I ran last year in 2020 and why I'm running again this year was to kind of really try to return a people's agenda to Schenectady politics and in particular to public education here in Schenectady with the school board.
Now, one of the issues on your website is the need for accountability and transparency. And I know the one issue that's gotten a lot of attention is that the previous school superintendent had resigned under somewhat controversial, I guess, or unclear situations. And then they went through the process of hiring somebody and that then fell apart. So, what's your perspective on how this school superintendent process should work?
Yeah, so just some more background on that. Superintendent Larry Spring, who at the time was one of the highest paid superintendents in all of New York State, resigned following a non-disclosure agreement with the school board back in March 2020. I was critical of that at the time because of my focus on accountability and transparency to the public. We find out in May 2020 that was essentially covering up complaints and an investigation into harassment allegations against Larry Spring. And that, like I said, he resigned and the non-disclosure agreement was to cover that up. So I thought the district's handling of that entire process was incorrect. And that should have been a much more democratic process that provided information to the public while also respecting the rights and privacy of everyone, of all the sides involved in that. But then going forward now with the candidate search, there was debate around last year's campaign among the various candidates as to whether there should be a more closed or more open search process. And what we mean by closed or open here is involved. It means the level of community engagement and the level of involvement by the public and the level of information that the public has about the candidates themselves. A fully closed process is, entirely the public doesn't know anything until a candidate is announced, until, the future superintendent would be announced. Whereas a more open process involves public forums, questions by the community and by the various stakeholder groups, of the finalists. And basically pushing the finalists having the finalists make a case directly to the people of the city themselves as to why they should lead the school district. I favor a much more open search process. The existing school board and both of the two candidates that I'm running against this year in 2021 favor a much more closed process. And the board actually just announced in their most recent meeting that they're going back, that for the second time, they're going back toward an even more closed search process. So they've learned all the wrong lessons of this most recent failure, which I should say, in terms of this most recent search process, they had, I think, two or three finalists announced, or they had announced that they had two or three finalists back in December. Those other finalists dropped out, so there was only one person remaining. The name of that person got leaked to the Times Union. And there was great dissatisfaction between the various stakeholder groups, unions, the NAACP, et cetera, about, you know, the lack of transparency in that process and really the tokenistic role that they were given at the end, in that process.
Okay.
And that was, yeah.
Yeah. Hopefully try to get two more questions in. Just running out of time. What has your concerns about the reopening of the schools during COVID?
There's been this kind of push nationwide to reopen schools. And the problem with this is that there's no real data to actually support this idea that schools can be safely reopened without mass vaccination. Basically, my position on this matter is just, as I said, there is no safe way to reopen schools without mass vaccination of the public and the full vaccination of all district employees. And especially where we are at the end of this school district, I'm sorry, not at the end of this school year, and with the vaccine just being opened up to the general public recently, there's really no way to achieve a critical mass of vaccinated people this school year in order to safely reopen schools. So the focus should be on vaccinating, you know, the public this spring and summer in order to produce the social conditions that allow for a safe reopening of schools for the 2021 and 2022 school year. And with that, I just want to emphasize again, there is no real data to support reopening schools now. And there's no infrastructure in place across the state, and in particular in Schenectady School District, to support that. Most school districts in the state do not do any COVID testing at all of employees or students, and they are reluctant to put any money toward that at all. But that infrastructure is necessary even to know whether the existing hybrid programs are safe to continue. Because okay. As I said, there is no data on this.
Let's get another question in. You know, one of the proposals recently has been to, I guess, create another or a charter school in Schenectady. What is your position on that?
I categorically oppose charter schools in all cases, but in particular here also in First Schenectady. Charter schools are essentially a grift against the public. They are a private business operated entirely or almost entirely at public expense and without any accountability to the public themselves, either directly to the people or via the elected school board of the district that is hosting the charter school. So as I said, they're entirely privately operating business that is almost entirely publicly funded. So that's a kind of categorical rejection of them. And charter schools, broadly speaking, I mean, we've had decades of data on this, and charter schools do not improve the educational outcomes of students. They can essentially cherry pick and filter the students that they allow and maintain throughout the schools. But even with that, on average, charter schools do not outperform traditional schools in educational outcomes. So on the levels of being, as I said, unaccountable and essentially a failed program, in terms of the failure rate of charter schools is also off the charts. I mean, majority of charter schools fail within, I think, the first 10 or 15 years of their existence. So they're a thoroughly failed experiment that Schenectady has actually seen the failure of, because we had a charter school that closed, I believe, in 2009 or 2010. So this kind of desire to return to this kind of failed experiment is just wrong on many levels.
We've been talking with Sam Rose, a candidate for the Schenectady School Board. Sam, very quickly, do you have a website or Facebook, people can look you up.
Yep. If anyone wants to contact the campaign, they can email me at votesamuelrose@gmail.com. And the campaign page is on Facebook. So it's facebook.com/votesamuelrose.
Thank you very much. And this has been Mark Dunley for the Hudson Mohawk Radio Network.
HMM regularly covers local elections. Tune in again to learn about other individuals running in our region and what changes they want to create.
Kate Phipps, the Education and Community Engagement Coordinator at Scenic Hudson, talks with HMM's Alex Winreich about her sessions for the Sustainable Futures Conference happening April 27th through the 30th.
My name is Kate Phipps, and I work at Scenic Hudson as the Education and Community Engagement Coordinator.
What's your work and how is it related to sustainability?
Great. So at Scenic Hudson, for those listeners who might not be familiar, Scenic Hudson is a land trust based in the city of Poughkeepsie, and we work up and down the Hudson River to protect land and open it up as public parks. You know, we really want to make sure everyone has access to, you know, the Hudson River and the Hudson Valley. We also protect farmland to ensure that there are still, you know, working farms in the Hudson Valley. We have an advocacy team that does a lot of advocacy work for the Hudson River and Valley. And then a lot of the work that I do is actually housed in our River Cities program, which we work in Newburgh, Kingston, and Poughkeepsie on various projects. And, you know, these projects are all focused on really strengthening communities and hopefully providing for sustainability in these cities in the future. So I also run the education program. And with the education program, you know, I think one of the reasons that I got into education is because I really, you know, believe that we need to educate and, you know, empower our youth so that they can go on to kind of spearhead sustainability, you know, protect the environment for the future. You know, and with this, you know, I do a lot of work connecting youth with their community and then also working to, you know, hopefully empower them and inspire them to be environmentalists and to see themselves as environmentalists and, you know, have the tools and the information to be able to really talk about their communities and, you know, issues that are happening in their communities and hopefully feel like they can, you know, speak up and be a part of solutions.
And what does green recovery in your region look like?
So I think thinking about green recovery this past year has really, you know, it's been a huge eye-opener, I think, for a lot of people. And it has really highlighted, you know, a lot of the strengths and weaknesses that we have, but also a lot of the needs of the community. And, you know, one thing that I firmly believe is that sustainable, you know, communities and green, you know, green recovery really takes all people into account. So especially, you know, those that are the most vulnerable and also youth, you know, so everybody in the community, I think, really needs to be taken into account. One thing that we've really seen over the past year is in the cities that we work in is the, you know, kind of how severe the food insecurity is. You know, we work with a lot of social service organizations who provide food for community members. And, you know, that's a huge need that we've seen. With this, you know, we've been working on a project in the city of Poughkeepsie to open up a community garden, an urban farm, which hopefully will be, you know, a resource for the community in Poughkeepsie in the future for folks to be able to grow their own food and then also, you know, have an urban farm that could provide, you know, fresh, super local food for community members in the future. I think, you know, another need that we've really seen kind of throughout, you know, our parks and also in the cities that we work in is really this need for open space and a need for people to be able to have access to green spaces where they can, you know, rejuvenate and kind of connect with nature and connect with family and friends. All our parks and preserves have all seen, you know, kind of record visitorship this year. And we have a lot of folks who have been coming up out of the city, you know, to visit our parks and kind of coming up to the Hudson Valley. And so, you know, I think that it's really highlighted, you know, the importance of having green spaces and, you know, not only these kind of bigger preserves outside of the city, but also in the smaller cities that we work in, you know, just the need for having great green spaces for folks who live in cities to be able to access to get to you easily, especially if they don't have transportation that will allow them to get out of the city, you know, to get to other green spaces. So I think, you know, a green recovery really takes into consideration, you know, everyone and really what the community needs are when we're thinking about it, so that the solutions that we come up with really work for everybody and, you know, provide solutions that everybody can kind of get behind.
What's your region's greatest asset in terms of sustainable planning?
When I think of sustainable planning, you know, one thing that we do, you know, in one of our kind of mantras is that everything is really community-based. And I think a lot of times, or, you know, in the past, that, you know, kind of community knowledge and community members' expertise can kind of get overlooked. So I think, you know, really working with community members and working with folks who live in these areas to get their knowledge, including young people. So really working with youth and hearing what young people have to say and, you know, what their, you know, ideas are and what their thoughts are on their communities. Because I think if projects really going to be sustainable and, you know, is going to last through time, it's going to be something that's done, you know, not just for the community, but really by the community, right? So you have community members doing this. We talk a lot about how our work can, you know, kind of be a catalyst in these communities. So how could we start a project that could, you know, catalyze ideas and really kind of spark people in the community to get involved? Because I think if a project's really going to be sustainable, you really need to have buy-in and you need to have community members who are going to kind of carry these projects into the future and ensure that they kind of continue on. And, you know, again, putting my educator hat on, thinking about the youth and, you know, getting youth involved, because, you know, hopefully youth will be coming back to their communities, living in their communities in the future. So, you know, really including them in that so that, you know, the projects kind of live on and they have community-based knowledge and community-based expertise involved in them.
What conversations and or work do you want to see come out of this Sustainable Futures Conference?
For me, you know, attending conferences like this Sustainable Futures Conference, I think, you know, the best thing that I ever get out of these is new relationships and new partnerships. Looking at all of the people who are going to be speaking at the conference, you know, it's a really diverse group of folks who have, you know, various expertise. And so I'm really excited to learn from everybody. You know, again, I think that forming unique partnerships is really a great way to go about being sustainable and thinking about the future. I hope that folks are able to, you know, kind of make some new connections and maybe some, you know, unique partnerships that will help to strengthen projects and make the things that we're doing, you know, stronger for the future.
How do you plan, or do you have any ideas of ways to engage the young people for community center projects?
My workshop at the conference will actually be focusing on a project that I've been working on for the last couple of years called the People Who Make a Difference Project. It's a poster project. We worked with students actually at SUNY Dutchess, which is the community college here based in Poughkeepsie. And so we worked with students to create posters featuring, you know, diverse role models, especially those from underrepresented groups in sciences. They focus on different environmental justice topics. So food justice, clean water, green spaces, and just kind of environmental justice in general, and climate change, of course. And so we have poster subjects and people who are featured that I think really have interesting stories that are very relatable. And so, you know, one thing that we've done is we've used these posters and the stories of these people who are doing work, you know, kind of across the United States to spark conversation with students and talk to them, you know, about different topics. I know Leah Penniman is one of the keynote speakers at the conference, And we've had conversations, you know, talking about stories like Leah Penniman's and others about food justice. And I think students don't necessarily, it's not something they think about, but when you start talking to them about these ideas and you tell them people's stories, it really opens their eyes and kind of connects them to their community in a way that they hadn't been before. That's one thing I'm going to be talking about in my workshop. And then another thing that we do, so with a lot of our projects, is we actually work with groups and we work really hard to be able to hire youth, to be able to pay them to do some work so that they can get, you know, some really great experience, some really great job experience and, you know, job training in, you know, kind of green fields. We also, whenever we do, you know, listening sessions or community outreach, we really try to engage youth in that process. We try to engage young people and have them come to our listening sessions because it's important and it's eye-opening to hear what they have to say. And they have definitely unique and different perspective than adults might have.
That was Kate Phipps of Scenic Hudson speaking with HMM's Alex Weirich. The Sustainable Futures Conference is happening April 27th to the 30th. To learn more, visit www.sustainablefuturesconference.com.
Now we hear from Megan Van Alstyne, an artist based in Albany, New York, about the importance of arts around the capital region and the ability of individuals to make full careers as artists.
Can you give some examples of how you've seen the arts be really beneficial to the Albany area?
I think in the greater region, there's things like SPAC that generate an incredible amount of work and tourism. There's the New York City Ballet comes up to Saratoga and it does a lot of their rehearsals up there. There is wonderful events that are street festivals that involve the arts in Albany. The New York State Museum is a beautiful staple that not only is that facility a museum, but it's actually also a research facility. So it's not only just creating, you know, interesting stimulus for the community, but there's a lot of research that gets conducted out of that facility, ranging from archaeological to ethnographic, even some mycology and geology studies. All of that is stimulated around the New York State Museum there and a lot of the funding that goes through. There has been huge booms, whether they're controversial or not, like the Jack Shainman Gallery that has come into Kinderhook that has provided, frankly, a really interesting and exciting access to contemporary art that the region really never had before. There are programs like Art Oh My. I worked for them for a number of years that have international artists mixed with community artists that do all sorts of dance, writing, visual arts, sculpture installation, with educational outreach programs for kids in the community, especially for public schools that don't necessarily have a huge amount of resource. Those types of institutions allow for community members to engage and participate and for kids to get interesting and exciting education. The New York State Museum has an after-school program that kids can go every day of the week after school and get help with their homework and learn about science and art and other exciting things that are going to help bolster their understanding of their formal education. So absolutely, there is actually a depth and breadth to the cultural arts in this region from all the way up through the Hudson Valley to the tri-state area that range from the culinary arts to dance to music to theater performances. And I think it's a really integral staple to our community and the vibrancy that is our region up here.
How easy is it to make a living as an artist? I mean, that's really hard to answer because, like, who is an artist and in what capacity? But when we talk about institutions being funded, are individual artists really able to live off of being an artist?
That, I mean, I think that's going to be a really big and deep and complicated conversation because it also depends on what you define as being a working artist. Is it somebody who solely exists on just the creation of making paintings or being a stage dancer? You know, working for the arts is complicated. I've been a dedicated steward of the arts for over 15 years, but it does mean that my existence as an artist and an arts administrator are deeply intertwined, that I do exhibitions and lectures and those types of aspects that are, you know, framed within, you know, the academic canon and the, you know, more idealized arena of being a working artist. But I also work for a lot of community organizations and volunteer projects. And that's, I think, also a big part for me as a working artist, to be immersive in my community. But somebody else's career path as a working artist could be very diverse. Generally speaking, it is often said in the nonprofit cultural arts center that it is a labor of love, that those organizations tend to be underfunded and excel through the dedication of the people who volunteer and work for those organizations. So I actually think that it's truly amazing for some of the organizations that I have worked with, for such little funding, how much impact they generate. And if they had ample funding for the resources that they need, I could only fantasize about the incredible impact that these organizations could have by having more access to resource and wages to hire more people. I would only imagine that the impact of those cultural arts organizations would grow exponentially with additional funding and support. But it's a complicated conversation about what it means to be a quote unquote working artist and what it means to be vested and part of the cultural arts organizations and network. But yes, it is possible. A lot of people are always, I currently am an arts administrator for the Berkshire Opera Festival. Everyone is shocked that I work all year round. I work more than I could possibly explain to you. It's actually a lot of work for a production that only goes on in the summertime. I work 52 weeks out of the year, all year round. And we actually employ, from start to finish, we contract over 120 artists and artisans, from costume to orchestra to vocal. And then there's our full-time administrative staff. And we're actually a really fairly, you know, small to mid-sized nonprofit. And we have that many people that we're integrating with all year round. Yes, it's totally possible to have a career in the arts, and what it means to have a career in the arts is a very complicated conversation, but it is possible.
That was part of a longer interview by HMM Sina Basila Hickey with working artist Megan Van Alstyne about the importance of artists. Find the full interview on our website at mediasanctuary.org. And that, ladies and gentlemen, concludes our show. We hope you've enjoyed this episode of the Hudson Mohawk Magazine. I'm Justin.
And I'm Kalen. Our engineer is the wonderful Sina Basila Hickey. This program is produced entirely by volunteers. To learn how you can contribute to local stories of social and environmental justice, email us at hmm@mediasanctuary.org or join our weekly Zoom meetings Monday nights at 7:07 p.m.
Tune in every weekday at 7 a.m., 9 a.m. and 6 p.m. to hear locals news. You can find all the stories on today's program at mediasanctuary.org, through our Hudson Mohawk Magazine podcast, and on our Facebook page at WOC 105.3 FM. Until next time, folks, thanks for tuning in. Stay healthy and stay safe.